Mainstream Mental Health Radio
with Dr. John Huber.
What do you think you are, crazy or something? Well, you're not.
We're on a mission from God.
News, issues revolving around mental health.
Dr. John Huber, a mental health professional for over 20 years, the chairman for Mainstream Mental Health, a clinical forensic psychologist, and a psychology professor at Texas State University. Breaking the silence of mental health, one day at a time, discussing the human condition, providing a sounding board for mental health issues, and making mental health mainstream.
You got a gift, my friend.
Now it's time for Mainstream Mental Health Radio.
Let the healing begin.
With Dr. John Huber.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Mainstream Mental Health Radio Show. I'm your host, Dr. John Huber. Today we have an amazing writer, a journalist, who writes for Quartz Magazine, and she has hit on some topics that I found very dear to my heart as a therapist, as a psychologist, and I thought it was intriguing and wanted to invite her to be on our show. And she has interesting ideas about addiction, about anxiety, and about all this social media, which we know and are learning that, you know, are causing problems, but maybe we're causing problems and not getting any gains from it as far as society is concerned. So I'd like to invite and welcome Miss Olivia Goldhill to the show. Miss Goldhill, can I call you Olivia? Is that okay?
Yeah, of course. Call me Olivia, and thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thank you for taking the time to be on our show. What got you into writing? I know, you know, you have your background in philosophy. What got you into writing about some of these ideas, like the addictions that we talked about before we got on the air, and the anxiety and how it can be a good thing for us sometimes?
So I have this background in philosophy, but I always wanted to be a journalist, and I've kind of found myself writing more and more about psychology and neuroscience and philosophy. And I think there's a lot of ideas and a lot of research that's really kind of fascinating, but can be hard to understand. And I think it's my role as a journalist to make it easy to understand, and also to allow people to question some of their assumptions. And I think there's always kind of accepted dogma and things that we think are true and are inherently right. And actually, there are very few unshakable facts. I think knowledge change and understandings of, you know, the best treatment for addiction, for example, all these things change all the time. And so I think it's my role to be questioning those assumptions and showing the new ideas in how we think about these major issues.
And I think you're completely correct in that. And you know, for example, when I first got into psychology, they figured the half-life of the information you learned in college was good for about 10 years, and then about 50% of the material had changed. What they found out now, the research is saying it's a little less than 5 years. So you take an intro to psychology course your freshman year in college. By the time you graduate, 50% of what you learned has already changed. And it's moving that fast. We're finding out that some of these assumptions and ideas that we think are true really aren't. And I love the fact you're putting that out there in the media. It goes right with mainstream mental health's goal to try and educate and keep people up to date with what's going on in mental health and psychology. So thank you.
Yeah, of course, and absolutely. And I would say I've noticed that, you know, people have a lot of admirable goals, you know, when it comes to mental health. More acceptance around it, taking it seriously, better forms of treatment. And I think it's very important to share those goals, but I think it's important to be willing to reconsider the evidence on the best way to get there. And too often people think a particular, you know, treatment program or form of perceiving these mental health issues is the right way. And that's not necessarily the case. You have to be willing to reconsider the evidence, always working towards, I think, those progressive values.
And I think that's true with anything involving mental health. But when we get into therapy, I have a lot of peers who have one orientation. They think, for example, cognitive behavioral, and that's the only way. And, you know, they have a problem when they get clients who that's not good for the client. And I think that a lot of us are kind of evolving into, okay, I have this one thing that I'm really good at, but I'm having to learn other skills in order to work with more patients and to work with each individual as an individual. And I think that's amazing that you're again, sharing that with the public. That's awesome. Thank you.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it is true. There are so many treatments out there, and it's often a matter of finding what's best for you more than there being one inherently right treatment. I mean, I think the thing, we have a lot of knowledge about mental health, but a lot of things that we're not sure about, true, which I would say is not the case of mental health versus physical health. I think in all of medicine, there are a lot of things we're uncertain about and don't understand to the detail that we would like. You know, we know that antidepressants are effective for many. We don't know the precise mechanism by which they work, which isn't to say, you know, I think they're a huge help, and when they help people, you know, they're wonderful, but just the idea that there's only one right treatment for anyone is suspect.
And I agree with that completely. And you've written other things, you know, and one of my pet peeves is this whole idea of social media. People are spending so much time on social media in front of a screen that they're not actually being social, and they're losing those skills. And as a species, I think we may be losing those skills in highly electronic involved cultures. And I loved what you put out about, you know, those tweets, you know, and you go in and maybe say something very politically motivating or spiritually religious based, and they stay right in that community for the most part. They don't go beyond that to people who don't have those same beliefs. So we're not really changing the environment, the social climate. We're just reinforcing and being cheerleaders for our own team is what it sounds like.
Absolutely, yeah, and I think you're right that this, you know, it so relates to mental health. I think, you know, the online behavior can be really fun and can build communities, but it also can be incredibly isolating, you know, and I think isolation and loneliness is a huge problem. The UK just this week appointed a minister for loneliness, and sometimes, yeah, what you're saying online isn't kind of getting through to people in the way that you would hope. I mean, the article I did, which just has such a powerful graph, and it was based on a study by psychologists from New York University, and they analyzed more than 560,000 tweets about kind of controversial topics, and they found that, you know, tweets that were, you know, really used moral and emotional language, they may have been retweeted, but only by people who share the same views as them. You know, there's hardly any interaction between, you know, those on the left and those on the right, you know, people who just have very set views. And I that's sad, and that's problematic for discourse if we're only talking to each other and not to those who with different opinions, and not willing to have, I guess, a kind and understanding discourse with people who disagree.
Well, and that's one of the tenets of a democracy, is to be able to have that discourse without becoming a battle of words. Just having that discourse is important. And now you mentioned moral emotional words. What could you describe, what, you know, an example or several examples of that, and how do you think those have that impact to get people to retweet, even though we know it's within the same team or same like thinking people? Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. So I'm just going on what they listed in the study. You know, there were moral words like duty, emotional language like fear, and then some words that are both moral and emotional, so hate would be one. And I think it really speaks to this idea that I see a lot in society, that people don't think that their opinions are just, you know, the objectively factually correct ones, but they also think they're inherently moral, that the only acceptable right view. And, you know, sometimes we're all allowed to have strong opinions, and sometimes there will be topics where you think that's the case. But I think it's important to question that and to consider, you know, is it okay to have a different opinion and to still be moral on this?
Wow, that's pretty deep conversation for a lot of people to think that, you know, somebody can have a different opinion and still be moral. And if we watch what plays out in the media, in the news, how immediately somebody with a different opinion and everybody who disagrees with them starts calling them names, a bigot, a racist, whatever, and immediately they're just not, you know, we've kind of labeled them immoral without actually finding out what's going on. I think that's just
right.
Amazing. You did a good job. I love that article, and the graph, like you said in the article, it just speaks volumes. And I'd like to encourage my readers, if you get a chance, go look on Quartz and look up. The title is "One Graph Shows How Morally Outraged Tweets Stay Within Their Political Bubble," and I think a lot of people will be just amazed at what you found out and shared with everybody.
Yeah, and I will say, you know, I don't think you necessarily have to abandon your views. You know, it's fine to have opinions. I did another article on, you know, how to get people to change their minds, and I think that's worth thinking about. You know, if you really believe something's true, you know, and if you think it's an ideal worth being upheld, you know, you can talk to people, you can listen to them, you can point out ways in which they're right, and then say, but have you considered this, you know, and kind of lead them to a different viewpoint and show that you're not kind of inherently oppositional. And I think, yeah, calling people names, it often does shut down conversation.
Exactly. So, you know, and it's funny because my next question was going to be, you know, how do you go and try to work with people to get them to try and change their mind? And, you know, I'm thinking two of those emotional moral words, moral emotional words that cause people to retweet that information. Is there something about that makes us just absorb the information differently, or do you think it does go to that, you know, we are morally right and we have a, you know, that in its intrinsic value of that, we have to do something because we have this strong moral feeling with that?
It's interesting. I mean, I'm speaking anecdotally here more than based on any study.
Right.
I've definitely noticed that, you know, a lot of people seem to thrive off outrage and a sense of kind of condemning the other side and then raising up their own view. And I don't know why it would be that social media would encourage that emotion, but it is something I see a lot of. I think, you know, I think morals are incredibly important. There is, I'm just remembering now, some psychologists who have done research on how you can speak to people's values to get them to reconsider a new viewpoint. So often people on the left will only speak to left-wing values, and they're not particularly persuasive to those on the right, and vice versa. But they found ways in which you can speak to values on the other side to kind of change impression of a particular policy. So one example I'm thinking of is they did studies on the environment and found that, you know, those on the right really value the idea of purity and cleanliness. And when that was kind of emphasized and kind of protecting God's creation, it was a lot more persuasive than kind of focusing on more left-wing ideas of collective duty. And then similarly, you know, for trying to persuade those on the left to be in favor of military having a military, that was more effective if you highlighted, if you spoke to left-wing values such as the way in which military training can provide a lot of opportunities to those from less financially well-off backgrounds and how it can be a real platform for improving meritocracy. I think you can speak to morals to try and get people to consider alternative viewpoints, but it's worth considering, you know, does this other person have exactly the same value structure as me? Should I consider a different value structure? And just being open-minded and willing to recognize that someone might have a different viewpoint.
So it's kind of the old school, know your audience.
Yes, exactly.
Well, you know, and as I think about this, I think it kind of segues into that whole anxiety thing, because when you start questioning your morals, what happens? Our anxiety levels start, you know, going up, because it's like, what have I been doing all this time if this is not right, if my belief set is incorrect? And you wrote that article about how anxiety can actually be beneficial. Can you kind of go over that a little bit for my audience?
Of course. So this was very much speaking to my philosophy background. I am a big fan of existentialist philosophers who wrote a lot about anxiety. And they did not say that anxiety was pleasant, but they did say that it was kind of a very powerful, important emotional state, kind of that it's a response to recognizing your freedom and therefore your responsibility. And so you have the kind of the power and the ability to make changes, and that's quite anxiety inducing. And I think that I wouldn't say that the contemporary kind of psychological view of anxiety is wrong. But, you know, I think anxiety is horrible and it is a mental health condition and it's not remotely beneficial to many, many people. But it's worth leaving room for that kind of philosophical understanding as well and that kind of questioning. I mean, people used to respond to anxiety by reading great books and reconsidering, you know, their values and what they're doing in their life. And sometimes that's not going to work, but I think it's worth having that as an option. I think anxiety can, while it's not pleasant, it can push you to do an awful lot of things, to be considerate to other people. I mean, someone without any anxiety whatsoever would have one of the characteristics of a psychopath.
And so exactly.
There can be ways in which, yeah. There can be ways in which anxiety can motivate you to do certain things and to achieve certain things.
Well, and you know, I think you're right too. I think when one of the things that I preach a lot of in some of the stuff I write myself is getting back to the basics. I mean, we're so industrialized, we're so involved in electronics, you know, and we've got glasses now. We can have our computer screen with us all the time, and they're talking about implanting chips in your eyes so that you can always have access to your computers and like that. And I think that may be taking it too far. We have to be able to get back to our basic hunter-gatherer self, get outside, get into nature, do physical things. And I think we're not doing enough of that. So when we do start feeling that anxiety, we don't know how to cope, and it becomes that panic attack. It becomes something that it is debilitating as opposed to the anxiety that I think Kierkegaard was talking about.
Absolutely. And it's funny you mentioned those activities because they're so important. I mean, exercise is just so important for mental health and time with community and time outside. And most health conditions, I would say, we all know are affected by social conditions. So, you know, whether, you know, I'm talking about physical illnesses too, you know, diet and exercise affects heart attacks. Smoking and sunbeds can affect your chances of cancer. But somehow there's become this accepted dialogue today where if you talk about the impact and the effects of social conditions or social conditions as a form of treatment, it could be interpreted as delegitimizing mental health. And I don't think that's the case at all. I think mental health conditions are incredibly real, regardless of, you know, what specific factors contribute to them. And I definitely think that taking the time to be with others and to get outside and have exercise has is a tremendous treatment option and should not be undervalued.
Well, at least where I'm at, I mean, I'm working at two different hospitals that I was invited to go by the medical doctors as a psychologist, and that's what we bring into that environment. And we've seen incredible progress made by patients who had not been making any progress until we started bringing those into their treatment modality, even including having them bring pets from home and come in and spend time with their pets when they're you know, shut into a hospital environment. And it's amazing how some of these people's lives have turned completely around with their physical illnesses. It's unbelievable in so many aspects.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think we have to consider all treatment options. You know, I think there's a lot of research at the moment, for example, in ketamine, which is an incredibly exciting possible form of treatment for depression that seems to be incredibly fast-acting and to be effective for people who don't get positive results from existing antidepressants. And that's, you know, completely wonderful and should be investigated and carried out. But it doesn't shut off these other options to these non-medical treatment options. We need to be looking at it all.
And I think that that's completely true, whether it's ketamine, whether it's psilocybin mushrooms, LSD, any of that. We need to actually look at it so we can honestly evaluate, as opposed to, oh, no, that's a recreational drug. We can't even consider that as being medicinal. And it's a big problem with modern medicine and in some cases modern science. So hopefully we're chipping away at the stone and going to get that to change.
Definitely. And I mean, I think ketamine, for example, a very first was, I think, a form of anesthetic before it became a recreational drug. And so now there's a lot of bureaucracy into trying to use drugs or investigate using drugs that are used recreationally as medicine. But, I mean, LSD, too, was, I think, invented by a Swiss pharmacy. I don't know if they had a particular medical use for it at the time, but they definitely had a patent on it that then expired. But, I mean, the results for the trials on these do look incredibly promising, and it's just so important, as you say, to look at the evidence and not to be put off by, you know, drugs' recreational misuse.
Well, you know, I'm very curious, Olivia, with all the broad spectrum of writing you do in mental health, where are you going? What are you looking at? What should we expect from you in the future with your writings? I'm excited.
Well, we will see. You know, journalists, you write fast deadlines, so I tend to get an idea and do it. One thing I know I'm interested in is women and mental health and anxiety. I mean, from my understanding, and I need to look into this more, but, you know, there is more anxiety among women, even if you account for the fact that women are more apt to talk about it than men. And just looking at the history of that, I mean, you know, there was a history of hysteria as a mental health condition in women up until, I think, the mid-20th century, where that started to drop off and melancholia started to increase. So just what are the social factors that contribute and create certain mental health issues among women? That's a question that I think I'll be looking at, hopefully in the near future.
Well, cool. Well, Olivia, you know, you're just fascinating. I've really enjoyed reading your stories in Quartz. Are there other places they can find out and maybe follow your stories, or is it primarily just Quartz? Where can my listeners go and read more of what you do?
Absolutely. So, yeah, I'm a staff writer at Quartz. So you should definitely be looking at our website. It's qz.com. We also have a kind of sister publication called Quartzy, where you'll sometimes see my articles. That's Quartzy. I had to remember to say Z instead of Z there, as they do in Britain. You know, I'm on Twitter, Olivia Goldhill. Yeah, Olivia Goldhill at Twitter, and so you can see a lot of my articles there. But yeah, please do come and read.
Cool. Well, where can my listeners get a hold of you if they have comments, or do you have a public email that you give out, or should they just respond through Quartz?
Definitely. My email is o@qz.com, so very short and easy to remember. Please do email me. I always love to have feedback and comments.
Awesome. Well, I really appreciate you coming on today. I hope that it was a value to you. I know it is to my listeners, that this is right down their alley, and I appreciate you taking time to be with us today. Thank you very much.
Of course, this has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you.
All right, so that concludes this episode of Mainstream Mental Health Radio Show. Again, I would like to thank our guest, Olivia Goldhill, and encourage everyone to go find her work and follow it on quartzqz.com, and follow us on mainstreammentalhealth.org, and share with your friends and family. And remember, life is what happens while you're making plans, so buckle up.
Thanks for listening to Mainstream Mental Health Radio with your host, Dr. John Huber. Check us out on social media, Google+, Mainstream Mental Health, Instagram at Mainstream Mental Health, Twitter at Mainstream MENTL, and search for Mainstream Mental Health on Facebook. Please tune in every week to Mainstream Mental Health Radio with your host, Dr. John Huber.